Thank you, Sabina. I'm very happy to be here among family, friends, colleagues, students. I'm going to speak about an area, a subject that's absolutely difficult, complex, heart-wrenching. There is no question about it that the crisis in Syria represents a colossal human tragedy. And it's also, unfortunately, a horrendous political gaffe. With more than 20,000 people dead, and the count is rising, with over 2.5 million people identified in need of humanitarian aid by the United Nations, with hundreds of thousands of people who are refugees in different camps, with a loss of over $30 billion so far, which represents about $1,500 for every Syrian person, one is to wonder, why would something like this happen? How could it be allowed to continue? What are the root causes that explain this crisis? Is there a hope that we can settle this? Are there conditions or circumstances or mechanisms that one can rely upon to change the parameters of the situation that would be contained and preventing this continuous escalation of course and difficulties? No question, there are incredibly large number and array of internal drivers, and I will go with you through some of these, as I have been part of a group that tallied and continues to monitor the unfolding of the humanitarian crisis and the economic crisis brought about by this conflict. But there is no way one can argue, and it is impossible to believe, that one can look at the Syrian crisis as purely an internal matter and that it is singularly, exclusively driven by internal factors. Geopolitical designs, plans, the Syrians like to call them Mu'amara, conspiracy, but whatever term you choose, there is no escape from looking at the Syrian crisis in its complexities as also a manifestation of complex and incredibly involved and engaged and intervening world. I will go through the number of parties, their agendas, declared or undeclared, their actions, overt or implicit, that have contributed to the escalation of this crisis and its sustainability, and stoking the fire that continues to burn in control. What started as a legitimate, and there is no question about the legitimacy of the Syrian people asking for more freedom, asking for greater participation and voice, for the dismantling of an intelligence apparatus called Mukhabara, that had played havoc with the rights of people and had imprisoned people, some of them Canadians, and tortured here on behalf of our government. The legitimate demands of these people and the civilian protests continued for months. The Syrian government oppressive mechanisms came into full play. It didn't have to happen. It started in March 2011 in Daraa, the southern town, which I would like you to see on the map here. Just get this one out of the way. It may be frozen. Okay, let's go. But Daraa, you see, would be the one just close to the Jordanian border. But what started as a civilian uprising with legitimate demands and was met unjustifiably by stone walling, minor and trivial concessions, escalated into an armed conflict. Today, the struggle in Syria is no longer a civilian uprising. The narrative that has been portrayed and conjured for you, that on one hand you have a brutal regime, on the other hand you have a civilian uprising only calling for democracy, is no longer. Today what we really have is an armed conflict, supported, sustained, financed, and supplied by a number of countries who seem to want their own geopolitical plans to be implemented. The number of people who are working on the Syrian theater and the opposition members and groups in Syria are no longer the domestic, nascent, and indigenous group that came out asking for greater freedom and greater participation and the removal of the fifth article in the Constitution that allowed for a state of permanency the emergency measures. What we really have today is a situation in which we have the Free Syrian Army, which supposedly is from defectors, but fully armed, with bases in Turkey and surrounding areas. You have also the Syrian National Council, which is absolutely and totally now colored by the sponsors and the masters that seem to be calling the shots. The Syrian National Council now is Istanbul-based. At one time it was Paris-based. There are many members that are in Doha, Qatar, and in many respects, that opposition has lost its legitimacy by being now in the service of forces that don't seem to have the best interests of the Syrian people. So on one side you have the Saudi Arabian regime, the Qatari regime, willing to finance very generously. The price is about $25 million for any ambassador to defect. They're paying the salaries of the generals and soldiers to defect. They ferry arms in incredible numbers and lethality across Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and some from Iraq. You have also Turkey that is now using an American air base with the Americans and NATO forces to continue to foment, finance, instigate, direct, and sustain the armed conflict. The Europeans are in tow with the Americans, and both NATO and the US say we do not support and finance and bring lethal weapons to the different opposition forces. All the records show that this is nothing. I will show you in a while something that just came hot from the press on this issue from the Le Monde Diplomatique, where they outline the many infractions and the many lies that have been conjured to camouflage or to cover some of these operations. Yes, the Americans are only giving coordination and training and communication equipment. They don't have to give weapons, because their client states in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Jordan, and some of the forces that they finance and supply with arms in Iraq are doing the bidding for them. On the other side, you have the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians. You have a few groups within Iraq. Not very over, but you can easily count the Iraqi government to be on the side of the Syrian regime. There is also Hezbollah in Lebanon. Many resistance groups too. The PFLP General Command, which is the Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command in Syria, Palestinian resistance group with the Syrians. You have Hamas, and you don't have Hamas. Hamas has not made its mind yet. All right. At one time, you know, they were in Syria with Mashal, and then now he's in Qatar. So we don't need Hamas in this equation, but I'll come in to explain and to try as much as I can and as simply and in a very direct way to organize the agendas of these people. Why is Qatar and Saudi Arabia so vehement and adamant about changing the regime in Syria? Why are they willing to finance and arm and support and have pressed into service Al Arabiya? This is one of the major satellite news agencies. Al Jazeera, that used to be the epitome of unbiasedness, objectivity, all of a sudden has lost all its objectivity, is pressed into service as a propaganda machine, trying to stoke the fires of the conflict. Why is it that Turkey, what Turkey does, why is it into this side? Just only a year or so ago, Turkey was one of the closest allies of the Syrian regime and has changed many of the parameters that govern the relationship. Syrians and Turks can move between the two countries without visas. They concluded a free trade area. They were moving into a very elaborate, systematic easing and expanding the relationship. Turkey had espoused zero trouble with our neighbors. They wanted no trouble with their neighbors. And then all of a sudden, Turkey changed, threw all these things out, and is taking a very overt, systematic, and unwavering support of the opposition. What does NATO want from all this? Why is Europe moving in tow with the Americans and has taken such a blunt and overt position on the side of the opposition? Right. So let's talk first about Russia, because it's the easiest. Why are the Russians, and they have made a major contribution. Without the Russians being in Syria and drawing a red line, the Syrian regime probably would have failed, or there would have been NATO intervention, the way that things were settled in Libya. But it did not happen, because the Russians, for the first time, drew a red line and considered Syria to be part of Russia's security, national security. But why would the Russians define Syria to be part of their national security? And why would they really be willing to go almost to war? I mean, some people say that the Russians are making gestures, but when the chips come down, they would probably not deliver. But it seems like the Russians have made it extremely clear and has backed their position with a major naval task force with a carrier, Kuznetsov, that is now patrolling the water. They have a base in Tartus. The Tartus, you could see it, you know, it's just a little bit north of Lebanon. Did you see it? All right. This is a port that now is a naval base for the Russians. They need it because this is the one that allows them to maneuver and to operate a naval force away from the prying eyes of NATO. I mean, they have one in the Ukraine, in Sevastopol, but they find it to be constrained by the Turks, who can determine and can block their free operations. In Tartus, they can operate in the Mediterranean, in the warm water, without any interruption. Little discussed and little is understood about the fact that Russia is very much concerned about the designs of the Qataris to bring natural gas to Europe through a pipeline that would have gone through Syria and Turkey to Europe as a substitute for the natural gas that the Russians sell to Europeans. At this moment, Russia depends critically on its ability to sell this natural gas. And it has been able to leverage the sale of natural gas. And once in a while, you probably have heard, they could close the tap in Ukraine or open it up, and they can determine whether Europe can sleep warm or cold. And they're not going, and they are absolutely determined not to allow a competing alternative to them through the Qataris or through anybody else selling. And they see that their stand in Syria and allowing and maintaining and sustaining the Syrian regime to block any initiative on that alternative gas line is of fundamental, critical, strategic and economic importance. The Russians are also worried about the cessation and secessionist tendencies in the Caucasian Republic of Dagestan. And they're not willing to see any Islamic forces, whether in Syria or any place in the world, taking the upper hand that might and could ultimately connect to the Islamic republics in Central Asia or creating a bridge in Chechnya and Dagestan. They're very much concerned too that if Iran, which they think the Russians, and probably rightly so, that the battle in Syria is a continuation of the battle that started 2006 in Lebanon, the attempt on by the Israelis to neuter the resistance in Lebanon, and today the fall of the Syrian regime, their ally, would be a major front in the war to change the regime in Iran. And they felt that if Iran were to fall, this would mean that there would be exclusive, monopolistic position that the West would exercise over the oil fields, not only in the Gulf, but Iran is squished between the two major oil areas, the Caspian Sea and the Gulf. That the elimination of Iran and the change of a regime in Iran would absolutely change the balance of power and control of oil flows in the world. And they see and have argued in very number of communications that they consider the battle for Syria is the opening battle with Iran. And that they prefer to put a stop to the encroachment on Iran in Syria. That the fall of Syria would have enormous consequences, undesirable consequences, Russians are not willing to accept that would take place in the battle with Iran. Why would the Chinese join the Russians? Right? Well, the Chinese also for oil interests. As you know, today China is the factory of the world. Today, China is the largest exporter of material that depend on imports and markets far away from China. And in this, they depend on importing an escalating volume of oil. In the 90s, China used to import 1.5 million barrels per day. Today, it's 6 million barrels per day and is not enough. And it's trying to cozy up to Harper to see if they can get even some Canadian oil. But there is a definite, determined attempt on the part of China to secure accessible oil that could sustain and maintain its export progress and command on the export markets. They feel that in the absence of Iran and in the exclusive control of the US and NATO of the Gulf, this is going to compromise the ability of China of getting its own supplies without the Americans exercising veto power on that access. And they're not prepared to surrender it. And in that respect, they also, and Russians and the Russian and Chinese are the same here, they got a taste of what the West seems to have for them and what NATO seems to have for them in what happened in Libya. In the aftermath of the fall of the Gaddafi, the Russians and the Chinese were promised that all their economic interests and agreements that they had concluded with Libya would remain intact and would not change. None of the agreements, none of the contracts that had been concluded under the Gaddafi regime with China or Russia were honored. And here, the Chinese and the Russians, but particularly the Russians, that invested very heavily in Syria, the story is that they have at least $10 to $12 billion of investment in Syria, that they are not willing to forfeit it without a fight. Now, you know very well, Iran without Syria would have very limited strategic options. Today, Hezbollah and Syria are insurance forces for Iran against an Israeli assault on them. You see, it may be very hard for the Iranians, once they're hit, to respond. I mean, nobody knows. It could not. But there is one thing certain, that if Iran was hit, Hezbollah would respond, and it is only 50 miles at most from the concentration of civilian, high civilian density areas in Israel. To Iran, they know all too well. You may say it is the Shia factor, but not. Far more fundamental are these strategic interests, insurance policies, so to speak, the allies that they have really been able to garner and nurture, and they find that this war in Syria is literally a war on Iran. Iran doesn't have an option, doesn't have a choice. They feel that the whole crisis in Syria is to a great extent rooted, anchored on a design to dismantle, to implode and to destroy Iran. But why would the Saudis and Qataris feel that they want to change the regime in Syria? I'm not wasting any of my time to tell you that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are really seeking a democracy in Syria. The Gulf has treated democracy like a bus. You get on it until you get to your own station. And then you get off. Alright? In many respects, the Saudis and the Qataris and the Gulf conservative regimes have aligned themselves with the Americans and want a change in the regime in Syria, basically and fundamentally in their design to neuter and to neutralize the threat that they perceive could come from Iran. This scare that they have somehow perpetrated, there is a Shiite crescent that is going to go from Beirut to Bahrain, passing through Baghdad and Damascus and connects to Tehran. This is a contrived one. I'm sure my friends, the Muslim friends here, know very well that the differences between the Sunnis and Shiites is not fundamental, is not as profound as has been made to be. You're talking about differences that probably extend back above 1300 years, if not 1400 years. To invoke these differences and these divisions is basically a ploy to mobilize Arab streets and Arab masses and Arab people to create a division between them and the Iranians. When the Shah of Iran was threatening the whole entire Gulf and sided with the Israelis against the Palestinians, they were friends at that time. So in many respects, one has to really take the dogged support the Saudis and Qataris are giving to be dovetailing their strategic interests with those of the Americans, and basically and fundamentally also being worried about opposition forces within their own countries. I mean, the Saudis are saying, well, why should we really wait until these troubles come to my own towns? Let's crush them, let's divert all the attention and energies, let them fight in Syria. The Saudis and Qataris are willing to fight to the last Syrian person as long as it doesn't really bring these uprisals and these protests to their own midst. Now, Turkey. All right, what does Turkey want? I mean, it's easy to say, well, Erdogan, he is the head of an Islamic party, Justice and Development, and he would like to see similar and like-minded rulers in Syria. I mean, there is something to this, probably. But there are strategic interests here. Turkey is very much willing to sacrifice Syria and to cozy up with the West, hoping that a price would be exacted, and this is a membership in the European Union. Turkey has a long-standing policy of joining the European Union. It has been rebuffed and is trying every which way to get back on good terms with the Europeans, even if this means to eliminate a neighbor. But there is also that game that they're playing by aligning themselves with the reactionary conservative governments in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, because this is really where the money is. And Turkey is saying, if I can get the money from the Europeans, maybe I'll get it from the Saudis. They're more generous than the Europeans. And probably not as discriminating. But Turkey is also trying to find a strategic posture. It lost. It used to be an advanced force of NATO on the border of the Soviet Empire. The Soviet Empire imploded, disappeared. Turkey lost its strategic value. It is searching for a strategic role and posture, and is quite willing, and all too happy, to exploit the Syrian troubles to refashion, reestablish, reposition itself. You could say, well, it also worried about the Kurds, that any weakening of the Syrian regime, any power vacuum is going to give greater freedom and movement for the Kurds, and therefore we want to consummate a change, a very quick consummate change, so that we have a new power allied to us against the Kurds that could constrain the Kurds and could disempower. And this is in the name of self-determination, freedom, and self-determination Syrians at the expense of freedom, self-determination for the Kurds. It's purely a political manipulation, no more. What does the United States want? Well, I mean, I'm hard-pressed, but let me try. All right? You could always count on the Americans turning in the thick of things and shoot themselves in the foot. Look what happened in Libya. But okay, let's see. What one can put rationally to be the interest of the United States? Well, the United States would love to have this exclusive control of the Gulf populated by either friendly regimes or regimes that do not oppose it. And therefore they see in Iran a threat. That threat goes a long way. If there is an Iranian here, we'll tell you that the trouble with the United States and Iran goes back to 1951, when Mossadegh for the first time stood up to the Americans and said Iranian oil is for the Iranian people, and that Iran should have the exclusive control of its oil. And what did they do? In a very democratic way, changed the regime. All right? They broke and toppled the Mossadegh regime. All right? Replaced it by a puppet Shah. Right now that the Shah has gone, well, maybe this is a great opportunity. Look, what a great opportunity the Americans are thinking. Get rid of Syria. It will be a major lost to the Iranians. And in the, as gravy, Hezbollah would lose all its supply lines. And we will get a Middle East that is totally controlled by a group, they call it Sunnis, I mean, I would like to call them conservative. It's an affront to call them Sunni and Shia because it's not true. They will control and they dictate their behavior and their performance. So to the United States, it's very crucial if they can get rid of Syria, they get rid of Hezbollah, they can probably get rid of Hamas, but Hamas is not noticing this, but maybe they'll wake up. And they will really get rid of any opposition to the designs and to the exclusive control and exercise of the veto power. The Americans have learned all too well, all too good, that they should exercise exclusively by themselves. I mean, and it's not just purely, because now you probably heard about this. The Americans don't need any more OPEC oil, not even Canadian oil. Well, maybe Harper will wake up one day. But they don't need us anymore. In 2 to 3 years, the Americans have enough oil that they might come to be net exporters. And with shale gas, they are already net exporters of natural gas. And the pipeline we used to bring, TCPL, which is the Trans-Canada pipeline to bring all the gas from Alberta all the way to the United States, now is going to work backwards. It's going to go from Marcellus in Pennsylvania and bring the natural gas all the way up. They don't care about oil for themselves. But what they really have learned, and learned very well, that if they exercise monopoly control on accessibility, they have a veto power. They can thump down any development in Europe or China or any place else that depends on oil from the Gulf. And that, they're not going to surrender it easy. You think that now they're becoming self-sufficient in oil, they pull all their flotillas and George W. Bush task force in the Mediterranean and the Fifth Fleet in the Pacific and in the Indian Ocean, and they bring them back. No! That's very crucial. The second one that is also crucial, and people have not really recognized this, is that the major beneficiary of OPEC has been the United States. I worked for OPEC and I was so happy at one time. We changed the price of oil, we raised it, we got control. The third world is paying back the first world for years of exploitation and colonialism. Nonsense. The greatest beneficiary of OPEC has been the United States. OPEC has been a fantastic mechanism, a vacuum cleaner. Took all the surpluses from Japan and Europe that they accumulated over so many years and brought them back to OPEC countries, Saudi Arabia and others, and went to American banks overnight. There was a phenomenon in the 70s, it used to be called the Euro dollar. Have you heard about it? Anybody hears about it? Gone. OPEC made sure it is not there. All right, and today who has too many dollars? The Chinese. How could they possibly have so much dollars? We have to see how OPEC can raise the price and we could clean them up like we clean the Europeans. All right, and they're working on it. You're paying for it. What explains that this price goes to 136 and tomorrow is going to be 130? Why is the price of oil going up? One of the claims I'm going to make, I'm on a limb here, and I have my colleague, Dr. Jenkins, I talk with him, he always does everything I say, but I'll give you a chance. I'm going on a limb that there is a contrived crisis that is raising the price of oil, that the Americans are happy about it. For no other reason other than it compromises the vitality, the capacity of the Chinese, the Europeans, and all the competitors of the US. And this has been a landmark, a plank in the strategic design of the United States. In the project for a new American century, this is a very clear statement, that oil is that leverage, that mechanism, that will allow exclusive control by the Americans over other economies in competition. But what do the Jordanians want? Why are the Jordanians siding with the Saudis? Well, I have no really other thing than say money. Okay? Jordanians are driving a real good bargain. They say, all right, you want to really bring arms? You pay us. The last price I heard, and my friends here who probably came from Jordan to tell me this is not true, they want $700 million to allow the arms to go through Jordan to Syria. Okay, I don't know, maybe they paid it. Lebanon, we have the 14th of March movement, aligned itself with the Americans, and there is a continuation of the Saudi design and plan, and they are on the forefront. They're trying as much as they can to create a passage, an area in North Lebanon called Akkar, so it becomes a conduit of arms and material and support to the rebels in Syria to continue to sustain the fight. So look at it. I mentioned all these countries on both sides. Did I ever mention that there is an interest for any one of them in the Syrian people? Nobody is concerned. Right? Everybody is after their own strategic interest, and they're pursuing it relentlessly and have no concern, and they have no abiding interest in the Syrian people. The Syrian people today are the victims, whether you're on one side or the other side, of this relentless campaign to undo one another and to use Syria as a theater of contesting each other's will and force without any concern or consideration for the Syrian people. You think, well, the Syrian people should awake to all these things. And if you can, conversely, sitting at McMaster, far away from civilization, think of it this way, why can't others do it? One day, domestic opposition in Syria have made it very clear. They wanted four things and are adamant about it. They want to change the regime, and if you don't change the regime, change its policies. They said if the only way we're going to change its behavior is to keep it, but change its behavior, we're willing to make that sacrifice, but only if five other conditions are met. They said no to foreign intervention. We do not accept to make Syria another Libya. We don't want the Syrians to have the same fate as the Iraqis. That the Syrians have seen what happened to Iraq. And any Syrian with any brains, with any interest in the Syrian people would not work to bring about the same fate to Syria as has been meted in Libya or Iraq. There are no to militarization. He said the first time we lost, the opposition lost, is the minute we militarized. Because we went from the high moral grounds to the same level and moral position of the regime. What distinguishes us from the regime when we use the same tactics? I mean, you probably have seen going into buildings and throwing people from the roofs, or lining up soldiers and summarily executing them. What makes a distinction now between the so-called FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and the regime? No to militarization, no to foreign intervention, no to oppression. We need a negotiated dialogue supervised by the United Nations or anybody. But we're not going to push to the last Syrian life. We want to bring new life to the Syrians. We want them to be alive to bring the new life to them. We don't want to burn them, to dispense with them in this major conflict. Right. There is also a consideration among these people that things are out of hand. They say to them, why don't you all get together, opposition? Oh, the Americans and the Turks are working very doggedly about bringing all the opposition together. But they know, I mean, bringing all the positions together means that you basically dovetail and succumb to the interest of those who are bringing you together. The indigenous opposition has refused to succumb to the dictates of the Istanbul base, or the Paris base, or the Qatari base, and said this is a Syrian uprising, should remain a Syrian uprising, it's a homegrown movement, should remain a homegrown movement, it's a homespun movement, should remain within the confines of Syria, and the interests of the Syrian people should remain paramount and above. Now you say, well, the other opposition, why didn't they follow the indigenous opposition? No. The first thing they wanted, and they continued to maneuver, and on every single occasion, they lost no opportunity to create a conditions that would provoke foreign intervention. They are always saying, no fly zone, so that the only people who fly would be NATO. It's no fly zone for the Syrians and other, but fly zone for those who want to destroy. They said, we want more arms. You know, the only way you want to help us, the West, you need your people in the West, give us more weapons, send us your black water. Actually, there is some there. And come and fight with us. As if more arms, more violence is going to make any improvement in the situation. They automatically, without even considering alternatives, have already surrendered in the process incredible Syrian constants. Or they will forsake the resistance. Hezbollah, who cares? Syrians? I have Syrian people who said, we don't care about Hezbollah. You don't care if you have cockroaches in your own backyard, you don't worry about cockroaches in your neighbor. I don't like this. First of all, neighbors in that region, this is one country. We don't have Lebanon and Jordan and Palestine. These were fictitious Sykes-Picot kind of titular governments that did not really emerge from the will of the people. Right? So in many respects, what we're really having here is a situation in which we are creating a stalemate. It seems that the interest is a stalemate. It seems that the design is for a stalemate. Well, that's the stalemate, not cheap. Of the shoulder of NATO, because a stalemate, it means that the military assets of the Syrian army are going to be whittled down. It means that the economy that is a major success story, as I will show you, will be whittled down. It means that the Syrian people will continue to be at loggerheads and will kill each other, and we don't have to worry about them killing us. We will consummate and we will agitate for greater division among the Muslims so they can maybe kill each other and save us the trouble. Alright? It seems like there are really issues here that we really have to sit back and consider. We want democracy. I went in 1999 and came up 2001. I was one of the authors of the Human Development Report that said there are three deficits in the Arab world and that you're not going to improve and develop the Arab world unless the three deficits are dealt with. First deficit is deficit of freedom. You cannot have any economic meaningful development if people are shackled with oppression, if people cannot participate freely and totally. And that you have to empower women. The second deficit is women empowerment. That you cannot have any society to develop and to thrive flying on one wing. That you have to have women to fully participate, equally participate, and encourage to be totally engaged in the development of their country. And the third one is knowledge. The third deficit is you cannot depend on your oil and on your resources. They are non-renewable and they're likely to dissipate before your eyes, if not you, at least the next generation. You have to build your economy and society on a renewable resource. And the only renewable resource we know is knowledge. It's the ingenuity of the people, it's their capacities, it's their skills. I still espouse these things. I want freedom for the Syrian people. I cannot believe that the Yemeni could vote and have all the freedom, but the Syrian cannot. But I want that freedom with dignity.
I want the dignity of an integrated Syria with all its unity. I don't want it to see that secular experiment that had succeeded trampled upon. I don't want that successful economy that brought and whittled down poverty to the lowest level outside the Arab oil-producing countries. Imagine that Syria and Egypt have the same per capita income. Syria has half the rate of poverty as Egypt. In Syria, 91% of families own their own home mortgage-free. Canadians, keep your hearts up. Unemployment is below 8% before the war. By the way, it's now 25% of rising. Inflation was quite low. Now it's 31% and rising. There's something in economics called the misery index. The sum of unemployment and inflation is, by God, really misery. And things are going to be more miserable. There is a way out. All right? The strategists say, yeah, there is a way out. Syria can get its way out. It starts a war with Israel. Everybody will be diverted. Everybody will jump and say, hey, wait a minute. Let's settle things. Now, there is a much easier, less costly way out. Dialogue. Reconciliation. What happened to the United Nations? I mean, one of the most important planks of the United Nations is peacekeeping, peacemaking, reconciliation, dialogue. All of a sudden, we've seen nothing but Chapter 7 things, and the Russians and the Chinese will veto it. One casualty in this war is the United Nations. Because as long as the parties in the permanent five don't work together, we literally disempower the United Nations. Another casualty, and something that you should be worried about, the continuation of the trouble in Syria is not something that you are not involved and you are not affected by. A casualty, a serious casualty, a one that is going to haunt us soon, is the unipolar world. We don't have any more unipolar world. Before, the Americans dictated everything, the Russians and Chinese were interested in getting the crowns and they were satisfied. Well, apparently they're no longer satisfied. The line has been drawn. Today we are living in the days of the Cold War with two superpowers are at loggerhead with major, massive nuclear weapons that can destroy the world over 10, 20 times over. And that's something, a consequence that we should really consider. We have an interest, personal interest, in bringing about a major and quick resolution of the Syrian crisis. And we need to do it as soon as we can, with the least amount of blood, and try to see that we can get the political process. Well, am I dreaming? No. Announced plan, 6 points. First one, reconciliation, negotiation, dialogue. Oh, we can't have dialogue with the government. Now, who the hell are you going to dialogue with? All right? We need to reestablish the principles of dialogue and reconciliation as the basis of resolution.